Thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce today our speaker. Kamala Nair is the Associate Curator of Clean Water and Climate for the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. She holds an MS in Environmental Science and Policy from Johns Hopkins University. And at the Marine Art Museum, she is tasked with leading efforts to create a 5-year climate action plan and manage the transition into clean energy and sustainable practices at the museum. Kamala strives to help build community resilience in the face of climate change and to explore ways the museum itself can be a resource to elevate climate conversation, hence the title of her talk, The Impact of Art on the Climate Conversation. And Kamala.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak to you all. This is such a great opportunity. I'm so honored to be here and be a part of the service. I know the topic of my talk is art and the climate conversation, but truthfully, my background is not in art, and I am the Marine Art Museum is really my first full-time job in the climate space. I would approach this conversation as more of my journey within environmental science and the emotional connections that I've made, how I view activism through my experiences that I've seen, and how that translates into my work at the Marine Art Museum that does center around art and the climate conversation. So I hope that's okay. Like I said, I'll start off a little bit about me, my journey, and then also a specific research opportunity that I got involved with that really shapes how I view environmental issues today and how I approach them. And then, again, going into the art and climate conversation, why it's important, the impacts that we've seen, and again, how that translates at the Marine Art Museum. So, for me, I grew up in Shakopee, Minnesota, was there all throughout high school, and then I ended up at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. I think they broke up recently, though, so it's just Indiana University. But I started off as a forensic science major. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, and then I thought, you know, I saw it on TV, it was pretty cool, who doesn't want to be part of the FBI, you know, so like, it just made sense to me then, but I quickly realized that though it is very important work, it wasn't the lifestyle that I saw for myself, and then I thought, you know, environmental science could be another option, it's something that I had always cared about, so why not, and I did find it very interesting, but what surprised me was the emotional I went through when I started the program. So obviously I cared about the environment, but very quickly I learned about the depths of environmental disparities that exist within environmental policy. Policy was something that I personally was more interested in, so a lot of my coursework focused on that. And learning things like how after colonists left the countries that they had occupied, environmental international policy was a way for them to continue to have control over the natural resources in those countries, even though they physically weren't there. Learning how that's kind of similar to how the federal government treats the Native Nations here in America. Learning about how the disparities with people, marginalized communities, people of color who have been, or people of lower socioeconomic statuses as well, who bear the brunt of the climate impacts that we face today, who have been, you know, facing serious health risks, dying, but not having the resources set in place for them to be able to fight against that. Learning that ExxonMobil in the early 1900s gathered scientists who predicted scarily accurately what our current conditions would be today if they continued to emit emissions and still doing so. Learning things like that, you know, it makes like, I just got here. This has been going on for so many years. It makes you feel a little hopeless. And I questioned whether this was something I wanted to face every day. But I think understanding that there's a privilege in being able to step away from that, relating my own experiences to some of the parallels that I saw as a woman of color growing up in America with immigrant parents, being surrounded by people who are so incredibly passionate about the work that they did, doing work that, you know, maybe in the grand scheme of things doesn't seem that important, but I've seen the impacts that it has on a smaller scale, which will eventually, you know, build up and have sort of a butterfly effect. It's still important work. So things like that really cemented an emotional connection when it came to environmental science for me personally, and kind of, as the book kind of talks about, you know, this is what I can do. So that's how I came to love my journey with environmental science and cemented my passion for that field. So now I'll just talk on an undergraduate research opportunity that, again, shaped how I view environmental issues overall. So I got the opportunity to work under one of my social policy professors, Dr. Nathan Cook, who looked at participation in community-driven development projects. So one big part of international environmental policy are these community-driven development projects, where the idea is that you give power back to the rural communities to make decisions on the natural resources that impact them every day. They're the ones that deal with this. And typically what happens is that, you know, you have some central government who's so physically removed from the community, the people, the land, that they're making these decisions for. So it's no surprise when these policies don't end up helping the people that they actually intend to. So these CDDs, as they're called, are a way of, again, giving power back to those local small communities. The work that he did was more focused on the global south, so Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan. And what I got to do was look at this household data where 10,000 people in Bangladesh were interviewed across 8 different districts. It's a public online resource. I didn't actually get to go to Bangladesh or anything like that. But so I just kind of looked at their responses and looked at how, whether people felt comfortable speaking up in these community decision-making meetings and whether they felt like they contributed, you know? So our hypothesis was that women and people of lower socioeconomic statuses probably wouldn't feel comfortable speaking up or felt that they contributed. And unfortunately, we were correct. So if you can see here, the red represents women and the black represents men. And you can see that in that first chart over there, women felt less comfortable speaking up in these meetings. And then they even less, they felt like that they contributed to any of the policies that were in place. Same with people with wealth disparities. So we kind of split them off into people who own land and people who didn't own land. And the people who didn't own land are represented in the green there. And you can see in both cases, again, that they're less than the people who did own land. So what does this mean, and like, why is this important, right? So when you look a little deeper as to why these women don't feel comfortable and why it's important that they do feel comfortable, in these societies, women are the ones that, oh my God, I'm sorry, I didn't give any context. So the management meetings were for the forest resources. These communities rely on their forest. And you know, if you're thinking forest conservation, someone might be like, okay, just cut off access to the forest, let the forest grow, right? But these communities rely on gathering materials from the forest for their livelihoods, especially the women. They're the ones that collect like fodder and things like that to either sell, heat up their homes, and cook. So you can't just cut off access to the forest. These women are no longer gonna have their livelihood anymore. And so that becomes more of an issue when you see that they don't feel comfortable speaking up or they feel like they didn't contribute. And they're the ones with the knowledge too, because they're directly interacting with the forest as well. So seeing the different aspects that go into, you know, we're talking about forest conservation, but now we have to look into dynamics of what are the relationship with women, with other women in that community, women and the men in that community. You know, how many women does it take for them to feel comfortable speaking up? So now we have to look at the social disparities that are present within that community that might be affecting this, like, forest policy. So that really opened my eyes to how complex and the intersectionality of environmental science. You can't talk about forest conservation without talking about the people and the relationships that they have with each other. So that really changed the way, or opened my eyes to how I personally would approach environmental problems when I see them. So who is it hurting? Who is it helping? And what different aspects do we need to consider in order for these solutions to be effective, right? We can't fight climate change unless everyone can be benefiting from those solutions. So now that brings me to art and the climate conversation and where I'm here. So that presentation I did on, like, when I presented on that community-driven development thing, it was on the scientific poster. You can imagine it's just a lot of words on a piece of paper, on some, you know, a poster board. And you would look at it, and it made my head hurt. Like, I liked it, obviously. I knew what I was talking about. I was passionate about it. But if someone else who didn't have that background were to see it, they're going to walk right past it, because what's interesting? There's no emotional connection there. So when we look at things like art, that can be such a powerful way to convey and have people relate to the human experience that's so present in the climate conversation. One of the biggest impacts, like, I guess one of the earliest examples of how art can have an impact is the pale blue dot, Carl Sagan's photograph that was taken of Earth as a small little speck, sparked such an emotional response. It really shows the insignificance of us in the larger scheme of things, but at the same time, showed the significance of how we should take care of this small little dot. You know, if not us, then who will? And that can also, you can also see the impact with how much funding space exploration got after this picture was shown and things like that. So it definitely, art does have an impact. Again, bringing that emotional connection to the conversations that have probably already been happening, but then having something like this kind of pushes it a little further and gets more people involved. A more recent example is the 5th National Climate Assessment actually included an art gallery as a part of their climate assessment of in the US. And so they understand that art and science move people to greater understanding and action. So what they did was they had about 800 submissions. I think 92 got selected to be a part of this gallery. And the prompt was just to make some sort of art relating to climate, any of the climate issues. It was open to all ages. And then they could send in a little blurb about what that art means to them. And I think something that also speaks to the impact of this is that this art gallery actually opened in the Smithsonian. But there was no publicity, there was nothing spreading the word about this, because at the time, the administration was very anti-climate language that would be present in this exhibit. So in order to decrease retaliation, it was a very, very quiet thing. And I think the fact that there would be something trying to quiet this speaks to the impact they realize that this can have. And so the next slide, I just took some pictures of some of the art submissions that you can see in the report. And again, there's like kids in elementary school to adults who posted about various different things and how they view climate issues. So again, really understanding that, one, this issue is something that impacts everybody, and the emotional connection is so important when it comes to conveying the significance of climate issues. So then now we come to the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. I think the fact that an art museum would have an associate curator of clean water and climate, again, speaks to the value and importance of having that intersectionality of those two different things. So I never thought I'd end up here. I never thought I'd be in an art museum of all places, but I'm so glad I am, because part of my job is to look at, you know, a 5-year action plan. How can we operationally make the building more sustainable, more energy efficient, things like that, that you might normally think of, you know, when you think of sustainability, but also exhibitions and engagement. You know, we have the unique opportunity where all of our art has something centered around water. And so that kind of provides an easy avenue to bring in the climate conversation on clean water, how that impacts us, you know, and then that can kind of stem into other things. So that's been really fun, trying to see how we can engage the audience with the climate conversation. And then also community convening, which is something I've really enjoyed about this position, is getting different organizations to talk to each other, how we as a museum can be a resource for them to have those conversations, to whether it's with other organizations, whether it's with the public, so things like that. It's been a really fun journey. And these are just some pictures. So the top one is Alexis Rockman. He has a very climate-forward message in his artwork that's easy to talk about. But then you have, in the corner there, that's a claw machine. That's part of our Michael Carrickan Ebb and Flow exhibit, where he has these landscape paintings of landfills. So that may not have a clear, you know, climate component or water component, but how do we kind of bring in that climate conversation without speaking for the artist? His artwork is not meant to have some sort of big climate forward thing. So we have a claw machine that has recycled water bottles that we collected from the community. And inside each one is a little like waste fun fact about the trash habits of Minnesota, Winona, nationally. And so, you know, someone might play it and maybe it just sparks a thought in their mind, makes them think about their own waste habits, things like that. So that in itself is a way for us to get them engaged with a climate conversation. And then that's my hand, and we thought there was styrofoam on the cement pad at the Marine Art Museum right on the river. When we went down there, we realized that it wasn't styrofoam, but little hackberry aphids. So that was really fun and interesting, and just the fact of like sharing that with the community through like a blog post, you know, starting those conversations, just seeing that the museum is a place that engages with that is somehow a way for us to activate those climate conversations. And then, you know, having events like the Pilgrimage of Hope for Creation that we did, where people talked about what the Mississippi meant to them and kind of walked along the river. And then treating our outdoor space as a seventh gallery. So to have people interact with their outdoor spaces is, again, a way of activation, you know, getting them to make memories, interact physically with the things around them in the environment is a way that we see activation as well. So that has been some of the ways that, you know, I kind of take in that well-rounded aspects that I've learned and tried to apply that to my position here.
What could be type of a thing?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question and something that we've been trying to navigate as well. I would say the biggest thing is, yes, this issue is really overwhelming. Is there a way we can provide people with like resources, you know, like, okay, if this really impacted you and you want to do something about it, here are some actionable things that you can do. When it comes to the claw machine with the trash facts, some of them was like, you know, take less showers take shorter showers. And like things like that, giving people different levels of how involved they want to get so that they don't leave being like, okay, this is hopeless, giving them some sort of actionable item. And I think that also these convenings, you know, like we're trying to do a sustainability conference with WSU in March. And so having these conversations, having people come together and highlighting the positive work that's going on around here, such as with like the Isaac Walton League, the Climate Citizens Lobby, they're all doing really great work to restore the prairies. So having people see that is also, you know, kind of giving them hope that yes, things are pretty gloomy, but there's things being done at the same time that you can support and that can help you know, provide solutions for these issues as well. So really highlighting the positive and also the negative together, making sure they see both. Yeah.
I think there was a question in the back.
Another great question, and I personally haven't had much experience with radioactive waste, but the one time that I had to interact with it was before this job. I worked at a tech recycling center in Minneapolis, and we got a lot of donations of old tech that had radioactive material in them. And so one of the biggest things that I took from that experience is that if you have any electronics, how important it is to donate them and recycle them responsibly versus having them end up in landfills where that can leach into the ground. And so, yeah, I had to make sure that those, like, they were stored properly. You know, there's a lot of people who are very enthusiastic about old tech, which is great, but then also having them understand the health risks associated with it. So, yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have much about things, the radioactive waste or where we are at in that aspect, but that's just, like, a small thing that I found to be very significant is just, like, old technology dealing with them responsibly, because I believe a large percentage of hazardous waste that end up in landfills are old tech. So
thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now close with a meditation. This is a very special Sunday. For our music meditation, Pippa Armstrong will play one of her own compositions. It is for a choral setting. She has adapted it for piano, of the Ubi Caritas. The full translation of the work that she put to music is, "Where true charity and love abide, God is dwelling there." Pippa wrote it in memory of an individual in a choir that she was with who was, as her words, dedicated to his friends, faith, and community. And it was a reminder to her in these times when so many people are struggling with health issues, with other issues, it's a reminder to her and to us that each moment is something to treasure, as the next one is never guaranteed. We will follow this with a moment of silence and after conversation. Thank you.